Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
Jim McCormick joins us this time by phone. I think from Michigan, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jim, even though you're out of the state, thank you so much for joining us by phone.
My pleasure, Ben. Thank you.
A lot of ground to cover, as usual, on Politics Wednesday. We invite our listeners to join our conversation. Of course, the first part of the hour, we'll be talking about this coincidence or not of the president and former vice president Joe Biden being in the state yesterday, trading jabs. Join our conversation with your question, your comment. Perhaps you saw one of them while they were in the state yesterday. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, as I mentioned, the president and former vice president were in Iowa yesterday. That marks the first time during the 2020 election cycle that the two have campaigned in the same state on the same day. President Trump's visit comes as farmers have struggled with declining commodity prices, also as the president's trade war has been blamed for declining exports to China and other large U.S. farm customers. Let's listen to a bit of the president from yesterday, touting his administration's lifting of restrictions that limited the sale of gasoline containing 15% ethanol to just 8 months a year. He predicted that his trade policies would benefit Iowa farmers over the next year.
As a candidate for president, I pledge to support our ethanol industry and to fight for the American farmer like no president has ever fought before. And we're winning these fights. And you're great patriots, I will tell you. We're winning these fights. You know, for 15 years before the election of 2016, farmers and farm pricing and a lot of things were going in this direction. You have to see the charts. They weren't pretty. And in a very short period of time, we're still working on China. Japan is going to be a big buyer very shortly. They told me the other day, we're going to be buying a lot of product from your farmers. And a lot of other places, you see them coming in, and they're starting to come in very big, very, very big. Mexico, you see what happened over the last 2 days, and Mexico is going to be doing a lot of buying. Within a year and a half, I would say you'll be in the best position that you've been in 15 years as farmers, and you deserve it. You deserve it. Last year, I came right here to Iowa and announced that my administration would open up the sale of E15 all year round. And now I've come back to announce that just days ago, we officially lifted the restrictions. You hear that? Joni, Deb, Pete, you hear that? Kim? A few days ago, we lifted the restrictions on E15 just in time to fuel America's summer vacations. We just made it.
The president yesterday speaking in Council Bluffs. During his speech at an ethanol plant in Council Bluffs, the president was joined on stage by Kevin Ross, a farmer from Minden. Minden used the opportunity Kevin Ross used the opportunity to encourage the Trump administration to go further and lift waivers the Environmental Protection Agency has been granting to oil refineries to avoid blending higher levels of ethanol into the gasoline supply.
We have more work to do. EPA's oil refinery waivers threaten to undo your good works. I ask that you listen again, because the pain the ethanol and biodiesel industries have endured is holding back a farm economy that has further capacity to produce more clean air and clean liquid fuels for this country.
Kevin Ross, a farmer from Minden. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Jim McCormick, first of all, at Iowa State University, as a representative of a big ag university in the state, recognized as such. Jim McCormick, what do you make of the president's visit and this ethanol move?
Well, I think it does fulfill a campaign promise that he made, although it's taken quite a bit of time to do it. I think he may be a bit optimistic of whether it's going to actually have the impact. You know, he's saying a year and a half out, and I think what really is going to be the issue is whether Iowa farmers will have the patience to wait for that kind of an outcome. And secondly, as you know, as Kevin Ross pointed out, unless there are not these waivers that are given to so-called small oil refineries, it may not have the kind of impact that the president has laid out. So I think, you know, it's still to be worked out. Obviously, it's a hopeful sign for corn farmers and so on and for Iowans, but it's obviously a work yet in progress.
Your thoughts, Tim Hagel?
Yeah, I would agree with that, that certainly this is one piece of the puzzle that clearly an important piece is the tariff situation. We often hear the phrase short-term pain for long-term gain, and that's certainly what the hope is. And, you know, extending the E15 is certainly part of that, even if it's not going to have full effect for some time. But the longer the short-term pain goes on, the harder it is for farmers to deal with the situation that they're in terms of both pricing and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Of course, President Trump, as a candidate, having tremendous support from rural Iowa. Jim, do you see this making a difference in rural support? What is your gauge now on how rural Iowa is supporting the president?
Well, it's really quite remarkable to me that his support has actually held up quite well. I mean, obviously, there have been in recent weeks some articles from, quoting farmers, you know, saying that, you know, their patience is running thin and some are going to be running out. But what I've been impressed with is that he has been able to maintain the level of support that he has had. This will help a little bit. But again, you know, this short-term pain, how short is this time going to be, or how long is this pain going to be, I think is really the question that farmers and planters will really be concerned about, because it's not just, you know, the oil situation or the oil waivers or the use of corn and so on for ethanol, but it's also they're facing these kind of weather disasters as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting you say that the support for Donald Trump is holding up. A March Des Moines Register, Mediacom, CNN, Iowa poll found that 81% of registered Republicans approve of the job Trump is doing as president. That's the same level as he had in December of 2018. So to be sure, the polls backing what you just said, Jim, his support holding up overall, though, in another poll from February, the same polling backers there, Des Moines Register, CNN, saying that half of Iowans say they disapprove of his job performance. So obviously there are a huge partisan difference there. Tim, does it surprise you that the president's support among Republicans especially is holding up with his agricultural base?
Not entirely. Again, we're still not really early into this process, but this again, there's still the hope that the tariff situation will resolve itself before things become critical. And certainly little steps along the way, the E15, again, it's something that it's a promise kept, even though the effects may not take place for, as even Trump was saying, a year, year and a half, something of that nature. And we're still a ways out. What will be key is what happens, of course, during the summer if things progress to a certain extent, and basically where we're at a year from now when we get into the heart of the general election campaign. And that's when we'll start to see whether people are starting to make their decisions, saying, well, look, we thought Trump was good, or no, we can't do that. And the thing is they probably, and of course it depends on who the Democrats nominate, but they may not vote for the Democrat. Mm-hmm. The question is whether they would stay home.
Mm-hmm. Joe Biden.
The other thing, if I could just throw in, again, I think this weather situation that Iowan farmers have been facing, and not just Iowa farmers, but Midwest farmers generally, how is that going to play in even with this E15? I think that's a calculation that, say, the Trump campaign, you know, has to take into account. Because I see, you know, that if there's not an immediate result of E15, there's going to be some and this kind of bad weather situation, can't get into the field to do their planting and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to have an erosion effect as well.
Mm-hmm. When you say this weather thing, you mean also should the extreme weather conditions continue for the Midwest?
Well, right. I mean, that. But, I mean, all the flooding that has occurred and the failure to be able to get their crops in a timely fashion.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Of course, the person who is leading in early polls for the Democratic presidential nomination, former Vice President Joe Biden in the state yesterday, perhaps a preview of what a general election matchup might look like. The president and Joe Biden repeatedly ripping into each other as unfit to lead the country during their visit yesterday to Iowa. Trump saying Biden was a, quote, loser, a, quote, sleepy guy and the weakest mentally, and claimed that people don't respect him. The former vice president taking a different tack, laying out the ways Donald Trump was, in his words, an existential threat to the country, its international standing and its values. So these hostile exchanges going back and forth across multiple campaign stops here in Iowa yesterday. Let's listen to the former Vice President Joe Biden campaigning yesterday. He told a group in Ottumwa that he hoped President Trump's appearance in the state would help farmers see how Trump's trade policies have hurt them.
And I hope his presence here will be a clarifying event because Iowa farmers have been crushed by his tariff war with China, and no one knows better than the folks in Iowa.
Okay, there, the vice president painting a picture that couldn't be more or less rosy than the president just painted. Tim Hagel, comment on Joe Biden's visit and his assessment there. Who are the farmers to believe here? I guess they will believe them when they look out or they look at their pocketbooks and their bank accounts, they will know.
Right. That's exactly it. And at least right now, again, the poll that you quoted earlier, if some 80% of Republicans are, and I'm not sure if it was more specific to farmers, still support the president, they're still in that wait and see mode. They're still saying, OK, we're still maybe enduring this short term pain, hopefully, even though the pain's gone on a little bit longer than we expected. But we're still going to wait and see. Well, at a certain point, they're going to stop waiting and seeing. And that's where I say, and as Jim was pointing out, with the weather conditions, are they able to get their crops in for this year? What's the situation going to be in terms of the end of the season and all of that? So when it comes time for the fall harvest season and so forth and what's going on next year, that's when we'll really start to see perhaps change or perhaps there'll be progress. Again, at this point, it's a little early to tell, even though nerves are getting thin.
Mm-hmm. Those personal jabs were in the headlines between the two yesterday. But to go further into what Joe Biden argued yesterday, that the president was, in his words, a threat to our standing in the world, Jim, he noted that the president had attacked NATO while embracing the Russian president. He said he had shown poor character by using crude language. He said he had embarrassing behavior that is burrowing deep into our culture, according to the former vice president. Jim McCormick, do these type of arguments, you think, have traction in this atmosphere?
I do think they have some traction, and I think it was sort of important to note that Vice President Biden, really attacked the president himself. I mean, he did talk about policy in some of his statements. I read his prepared set of remarks, and he did talk a little bit about policy, but the gist of his whole comments were really directed wholly at Trump, and he really and his campaign people believe that this is the way to make inroads, because there is this kind of, particularly in the primary season, as he's seeking the nomination, the visceral dislike for the president among, say, caucus goers or Democratic identifiers really stands him in good stead. Mm-hmm. But you're right. He said that there was this you're going to help me here.
Existential
threat to the country by President Trump, because he attacked core values and our standing in the world and even democracy itself, he says, by claiming so much power to the presidency. So I do think that has value in terms of particularly the caucus goers and the primary voters here.
Okay, Jim McCormick will be back with us in just a few minutes of Iowa State University. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, as we continue this Politics Wednesday edition of our program. When we come back, we'll talk about some other happenings yesterday with the president's visit, one involving U.S. Representative Cindy Axne of Iowa's 3rd District. I'm Ben Kiefer with Tim Hagel and Jim McCormick. It's a Politics Wednesday. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're glad you're on board for this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Tim Hagel, the University of Iowa, and Jim McCormick at Iowa State University joining us today by phone from Michigan, our political analysts for this week in the first half hour. If you were not with us, talking about the president's visit to the state yesterday, which happened to coincide with a campaign stop by former Vice President Joe Biden, away from that main fray, if we can call it that. This story connected with it. Perhaps you can comment on this. A U.S. Representative, Democrat Cindy Axne of Iowa's 3rd District, said the White House rescinded an invitation for the Iowa congresswoman to join Donald Trump on his tour of that renewable energy facility in Council Bluffs. Now, the White House denies Axne's claim, saying that Axne wasn't invited on the tour in the first place. The Des Moines Register reporting it obtained documentation of an invitation the White House sent to Axne to visit the facility, but makes no reference to a tour with the president. Yesterday, Axne sent a letter to the president accusing the staff of his administration of stopping her from appearing with the president. So, of course, this renewable energy facility in Council Bluffs is in the 3rd District. That's Axne's district. Tim Hagel, your thoughts on what happened here? A mix-up of communication?
Well, it's possible that it's that. It's possible that, you know, maybe it was rescinded or the staffer didn't understand what was going on. There was a bit of a mistake there. Sometimes you do get these miscommunications. It's kind of an odd situation where you have, not unusual to have, people, a representative of one party appearing with the president of another party. Famously, Chris Christie gave that hug to President Obama, and of course it hurt Christie politically, but it was something that, you know, was Superstorm Sandy, that Christie was grateful for the support that Obama was giving to the region for disaster relief. And so, and this was a situation where maybe the Democrat Axne would have liked to have been at this particular plant. But then there's always the possibility, if you have guests like that, if they're going to speak and if they're going to dilute the message or change the message or change the focus. So sometimes you don't want to have that happen. So maybe that's what was going on. But like I say, it could have been that staffer made a mistake in sending out or was unclear in sending out the information. It's hard to say exactly what's going to what happens, but it probably, more than anything else, it may benefit Axne, because she can make something of this and talk about how, oh, well, I was invited, now is disinvited. And so that gets her a little bit of publicity as well.
It certainly went on our radar earlier in the week when the Axne campaign or Axne's office sent out this announcement of a tour with the president. Jim, did that strike you as unusual for a Democratic representative who unseated David Young, a Republican in Iowa's 3rd District, to be going on tour of an ethanol plant with a Republican president, this Republican president?
Yeah, it did strike me as really unusual, particularly, as you may have noticed, the two senators who are Republicans, of course, were at this tour with the president. So it sounds to me like what happened was there was, kind of an instruction in the White House to send out invitations to the officials, and they, I guess they didn't get quite clear that Cindy Axne was of the other political party here. So, it did really strike me as unusual.
Interesting, with one of Iowa's other members of Congress, Representative Steve King, of course, a long time, the longest serving member of Congress in Iowa's four congressional member group there. He was not allowed, according to reports, to fly aboard Air Force One as the president traveled to Iowa, according to two GOP officials reportedly telling CNN this. Evidently, Steve King had asked the White House to join the president's entourage, but the administration officials rejected that request. Republicans Joni Ernst, our U.S. senator, also Deb Fisher of Nebraska, did join the president aboard Air Force One. We should note here, we remember that Steve King was stripped of his congressional committee assignments earlier last year, from his own party. He did attend the Republican Party of Iowa's fundraising dinner in West Des Moines, where the president was there. That was yesterday evening. And he faces a primary re-election bid this year. Tim Hagel, what does this tell you about Steve King's standing in his party, if anything, and his standing with Donald Trump?
Well, it certainly suggests that maybe he's, if not persona non grata, at least kind of on the outs, so to speak, because of things that he said. And that's understandable that a president, regardless of who it is, if you have a member of your party that seems to be having some problems politically, that sometimes you're going to distance yourself from that person. And that maybe is what's going on with Donald Trump. And it's hard to say that sometimes these things are hard to read, but that would seem to be the case. And as you mentioned, that Steve King's going to get a primary. Now, he's been primaried the last time and the time before that, unsuccessfully, of course. But this time it seems that maybe there are a number of people that are more serious about it. And given the problems that King is having, he's fighting back. And it seems that a number of Republicans in his district are still supporting him. But we'll see how that goes over the next year, basically.
Mm-hmm. Back to add on to our conversation of the president and the leading the Democrat leading in the polls at this point for the Democratic nomination, former Vice President Joe Biden. I'm looking on my screen. This brand new from today, a new national poll from Quinnipiac University showing President Trump trailing each of six Democratic candidates in potential head-to-head contests and calling Joe Biden's advantage of landslide proportions. Leading ranges in this poll from 5 points for Cory Booker and Pete Buttigieg to 13 points for Biden. How much does this mean at this point, Jim McCormick, when the general election is so far away, to have this kind of a poll with a head-to-head?
Well, I don't think you can put too much stock into it, but it does give a signal, you know, that the president is really in trouble here. Because many of the, you talk about Cory Booker even being ahead of him, and Cory Booker registers at really a very low percentage. I think in the Iowa poll, was he at 2% or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
This is really, a sort of a wake-up call to the administration. On the other hand, I think the poll showed that Biden had something like a 13-point lead on Trump, and that other polls have shown in some of the sort of the key battleground states, particularly in the Midwest, that Biden was ahead. And I think while these are obviously still early, they do serve as kind of a warning to the president and his campaign people, mm-hmm. that they're going to have a real challenge.
Joe Biden out in front, according to the latest poll of Iowa voters released on Saturday. This is the Des Moines Register CNN poll. Biden's support narrowing, retaining a significant advantage over his Democratic competitors there. He's at 24%, a second place sort of statistical, three-way statistical tie for second place. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. Now, responding to this most recent Iowa poll that shows him in a virtual tie for second place, Vermont Senator, rather, Bernie Sanders, predicted on CNN's State of the Union that no Democratic candidate would achieve 50% support.
We're not going to get 50% of the vote in Iowa. I don't think anybody will. I think we have an excellent chance to win here. We're going to win in New Hampshire. And I think we have a very strong chance of being the candidate who will defeat the worst president in the modern history of this country, Donald Trump.
Tim Hagel, comment on that, how this field will winnow and eventually, what would be the percentage win of the winner of the Iowa caucuses in the 30% range, 30 to 40%? Is that in keeping with past Iowa caucuses, or is this an outlier?
Well, it's certainly an outlier in terms of the number of people that we have running for the nomination at this point at 23, although I occasionally see people saying 24, and I'm not sure who that 24th is. In any case, what I think we're going to see, though, is that some of these folks that are at 0% or 1% in the Iowa poll will probably start to drop out once we get into the Democratic debates, particularly the third debate, where they're going to increase the requirements to get in with you have more donors and so forth. And at that point, some of these folks will drift aside. So we probably won't have the same number of people at the caucuses. But the thing about the caucuses is they, especially the way the Democrats run them, is that because of the 15% preference groups, that you'll have some winnowing that night. I think Senator Sanders is correct that we probably won't see somebody with 50%, but we'll probably see people in that 30% range at least, maybe two, three, something along those lines, and maybe get three, maybe you'll have a fourth candidate that will actually get enough, get above that 15% thing is a statewide sort of a percentage.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, I want to lean on your foreign policy expertise to ask about what's popped up in the headlines today in Hong Kong. Demonstrators protesting a contentious extradition bill, throwing bricks, bottles, other objects at riot police, guarding Hong Kong's legislative council. The police responding with tear gas, pepper spray, rubber bullets. I know you keep your eyes on this part of the world. Put this violence we're seeing today in Hong Kong in context. What is this about?
Well, it's really about whether democracy will be preserved within Hong Kong. You know, under the return of Hong Kong to China in 1997, they were supposed to have, you know, one nation, two systems. And, you know, obviously there's a strong, when the British were in control of Hong Kong, a strong democratic kind of commitment there. And that seems to have been eroded. There was, you may recall, the so-called umbrella movement in 2014 in which they wanted to call for, you know, the greater democratization. And even the legislative body that's elected is really elected indirectly within Hong Kong. And Carrie Lam, who's the chief executive in Hong Kong, was really elected by this kind of council. So there's not been this kind of real democratization that has taken place. And this extradition law is yet one more symbol of the sort of tightening of the grip that, or at least that some are seeing, that the PRC, the People's Republic of China, is putting on Hong Kong and moving away from this kind of idea of having one nation and two systems here, and where democracy would be preserved, and the extradition law is sort of one element of this, because under this law, as I understand it, it is possible that somebody that's under suspicion could be transferred to the PRC, to the People's Republic of China, and they would be subject to a judicial system that would be under control of the Chinese Communist Party. So, this is, I think, really this part of the effort to maintain some democratic semblance within Hong Kong. But I think the longer picture is that there's been a real erosion of this, and whether these demonstrations will have any tangible impact, I think, is still very questionable. There has been a slight delay on the vote on this extradition bill, apparently. First, it was going to be at the end of the month. Then they were talking about even earlier, June 20th. Now there's at least been some delay in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is a pause probably before the Legislative Council simply goes ahead with this bill.
Hong Kong, long having been a thorn in mainland China's side, is what you seem to be indicating. It's more a matter of how long it will take than whether this resisting mainland China will be successful.
That's right. I mean, under the provision in 1997, this was to last at least 50 years, that they would have one nation, two systems. But the view is, I think, of many of those demonstrators undoubtedly is that the tightening of control from the mainland has already begun, and that will not even last that 50-year cycle that was originally agreed to when the British turned back Hong Kong to the People's Republic of China.
Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, our two political analysts this week on Politics Wednesday. Let's pivot back to domestic issues and that ongoing impeachment debate the Democrats are having in the U.S. House. This week, the U.S. House authorizing its committee leaders to pursue civil contempt cases to get information for their many investigations into President Trump. The vote clearing the way for more lawsuits against cabinet departments, administration officials, bankers, others. Leaders in the House had contemplated holding the Attorney General, Bill Barr, and the former White House counsel, Don McGahn, in contempt of Congress. Instead, we had this happen yesterday, Tim Hagel. The House simply permitting civil lawsuits against the Attorney General and McGahn. What does this move represent in your eyes?
Well, it's a combination of things. The obvious thing is, of course, wanting to some extent, paralyze the administration to harass President Trump because, you know, they don't like him. They don't think he's done good things. They think, I suspect honestly to a certain extent, that Trump has done things that are worth investigating that perhaps are even criminal. And a number of members of Congress have said that flat out. Obviously, the administration says otherwise, and Republicans in Congress don't agree with that. And so that's where we get to sort of the second level of this, where aside from the political harassment, then you get the fight between the two branches of government. And one of the things that we've seen for many years is that the president has taken more power in Congress, either because of split control or just an unwillingness to act, has sort of let the president, whoever it happens to be, take on more power. And so now Congress, again, partly for political reasons, or at least that sets the stage for this, that they're trying to take back some of this power and say, look, you know, this is our job to investigate. Oversight is an important part of what Congress does. A number of Congress members have said that flat out. And so that's what they're trying to do. And they're trying to exert their authority and resisting, no surprise, the administration is resisting that by saying, well, look, you can't just get all this information, both in terms of cabinet sorts of things, government activities, as well as the personal stuff from the president himself.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think that's very very astute what Tim has laid out here. I think part of this is, too, to kind of keep this issue alive. I mean, I'm sure that there are some members of the Judiciary Committee that really want to go full bore in terms of finding out any kind of wrongdoing. But I also think that it sort of keeps this issue on the agenda here and keeps the administration on a kind of a defensive. So it has that political impact aside from any kind of legislative or legal assessment that the members might be undertaking.
Another interesting story on this note from this week, John Dean, Congress's star Watergate witness from the 1970s, returned to Capitol Hill on Monday at the request of the Democrats. Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee, though, as it turned out, aimed to sort of relitigate Dean's role in Watergate more than 40 years ago. In their questioning of him, they questioned his honor. They pointed to his own admitted obstruction of justice at the time for which he served time, and they accused him of profiting off of his Watergate experience as a television commentator who frequently criticizes this president. First to you, Jim McCormick, I don't know if you came of age in your political interest at the time when John Dean was in his first testimony.
Fortunately or unfortunately, I saw John Dean testify at the Watergate hearings. So not in person, but on television.
Yeah. Your thoughts on this move by the Democrats to have him there? Did it work? Did it backfire?
I think it was more of simply trying to keep this item on the political agenda. I was hard pressed to see what he could really add to sort of the substance of the discussion. I mean, he certainly did try to make parallels with what happened back in 1973. He obviously can't, and even said himself, he's not really an expert witness here that he could have any kind of testimony. So I think there was a little bit more grandstanding than anything else.
Agreed, Tim Hagel.
Yeah, it's pretty much a political stunt. Now, given his position, I suppose he has a certain amount of expertise, but as was indicated, he spent a lot of time in the intervening years basically making the case for, if not himself, but sort of profiting off of experience. Now, it's, of course, understandable, given his experience, to issue warnings saying, hey, this is what I'm seeing similar things. But at this point, at least, and although, again, some members of Congress have likened what's going on to Watergate, sort of bringing that up and sort of the shame of a Republican president and what he had done and so forth. But at least at this point, those analogies really aren't quite there, that we don't have sort of that underlying crime that we had with the break-in of the office and so forth, what was going on in Watergate. So, of course, some members of Congress would argue, well, we have obstruction of justice, and other people are going to argue otherwise. And that's the problem, is we don't have anything clear cut that everybody's going to agree on, saying, yes, this is a crime, now we need to investigate this, and then have a clear situation where there was that obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, when John Dean testified in 1973, of course, his testimony was riveting because he, of course, acknowledged the kind of crime that was going on in terms of obstruction.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Do we, the Mueller report now, several weeks after it's been released, most Americans, 99% have never read the 400-plus page report there. Jim McCormick, on the way out, I don't know how much you've been able to read of the report. We have less than a minute here. Do you think the obstruction claims are worth investigating? And do you think there's possibly something there that the president should be worried about?
Well, I think if the committee gets a hold of some of these interviews that they had that they've requested in terms of from the attorney general, they might be able to ferret through there and come up with something that might give them some fodder for this obstruction charge. But at least from the report itself, I think you really cannot quite get there.
Okay. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim and Jim, thank you very much for joining us on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks, guys.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.